Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark and my guest is a newcomer, and maybe even a nightcomer, but a newcomer to the book club. Welcome to Steve Lahr. Steve, welcome to the book club.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No trouble at all. Great pleasure. Now, I actually recruited you from the Facebook group of another podcast, which we'll be talking about towards the end of this.
Yep.
A podcast that's got some relevance to the book we're going to be talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get there, we start with your own comics or 2000 AD origin stories. What were your first comics?
Well, in all honesty, Scream was probably one of the first concerted comic collections that I ever got. I probably had the odd copy of the Beano, I think, around that time. I mean, I was very young when Scream came out. I was about five. So I remember seeing it at the newsagent at the time and just being very keen and curious as to what this new comic was. After Scream, it was probably things like Transformers, the Marvel UK Transformers. And then I went through a phase of Whizzer and Chips. And then, of course, you get into your teens and you head towards the American comics like X-Men and Wolverine and all the anti-heroes like Batman. I had quite a large Batman collection at one stage. And then you get that bit older and, of course, went on to some more intense reading. So it was like Watchmen and Preacher. And then I think in my early 30s, I kind of discovered 2000 AD. And it was Carlos Esquerra's work on Strontium Dog, actually, that I'd noticed first. And I was just kind of like blown away. And it just rung bells with me. And I was like, I've seen that somewhere before. And I then started reading 2000 AD and the magazine. And getting very much into that sort of world. I have subsequently drifted, but every now and again I do sort of pick up bits here and there. And I was very pleased when I saw that Rebellion were doing the British Treasury of Comics and in particular releasing Scream as the bound volume. I was very, very happy.
Well, let's get into it then. Tell us, what is this book that we're talking about that I've dragged you on to talk about?
Well, it's a sort of collection of the 15 issues of Scream that came out 40 years ago, all collected together in a really beautiful hardback edition. Absolutely stunning. It's got, like I say, all 15 issues, unfortunately only 15 issues because it was very quickly cancelled. The adverts have been removed, which a part of me is a little upset about because you just kind of want that little frisson of nostalgia from the old days. And I would have loved to have had like the introductions by Ghastly McNasty, but other than that, it's absolutely stunning, and I pored over it for hours, just absorbing the stunning artwork and some truly great stories.
So 40 years of Scream in a massive hardback, collects all the issues, plus the holiday specials. There's some back matter, which we might get to later. There's introductions by both Ian Rimmer and Barry Tomlinson. Did you, before I get to that, we'll judge a book by its cover. Did you get the David Roach or the sort of standard 40 years guys?
I did get the standard cover, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Which, as we'll talk about later, is also getting very hard to find as well.
I can imagine.
So, 15 issues of Scream. Did you get all the issues at the time? Because you're at the sort of slightly at the young age for this comic.
Yes. Yeah. Now, it's although, like I say, it was very young at the time, I remember getting that first issue. I remember those plastic Dracula teeth on that front cover. And I remember seeing the comic in the newsagents, and it was the counter. The comics were kept below, like, the counter at the front. And I remember seeing it, and I know that my mum, she wasn't particularly happy about me having it. But no, I did get, I think I got all of the issues, because I remember when it stopping, and just, I was at an age where I hadn't realized, oh, it had been cancelled. It was just that it wasn't appearing in the newsagents anymore. I had no clue why. But no, I do remember getting, I think I got every issue. But at that age, they don't last long.
Hmm.
They get destroyed very, very quickly. And I think it was issue 8 with the werewolf on the front cover? I remember that one going missing one time and hunting high and low for it. And I swear my mum got rid of it. I swear she got rid of it. She was very unhappy about me reading Scream. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
So Scream was, as we've said, a 15-issue horror comic from IPC from March to June in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably right to say that the creation of the comic, and it's partly responsible for its demise, was a slight tension backwards and forwards in IPC as to whether they should be doing a horror comic for kids.
Yeah. I mean, I find that odd, considering they'd already had Misty for quite some time. And I don't know, maybe they thought that it was a softer girls comic, so it was okay. And I looking through this collection now, I was probably too young to be reading it, but because I know that there are images in here that I know gave me nightmares. I was flicking through it and was like, actually, the memories just came flooding back from certain images, and I thought, wow, yeah, this had such an impact on me. But it is a shame that they were so determined, seemed to be so determined to cancel it so soon.
We've mentioned Barry Tomlinson, handed over to editor Ian Rimmer, who was the sort of man behind the Ghastly McNasty persona. Simon Furman, of course, you've mentioned Transformers UK. Mm-hmm. Simon Furman, a great sort of part of that. But Simon Furman, I think, was his deputy editor on this.
Yeah.
And we know from reading, I think, the introductions and also from other histories of British comics, like I say, this slight tension the whole time as to whether it was too scary, whether it was not scary enough. I'm fascinated that in your particular case, horror fans always seem to have some seminal horror experience when we were probably far too young to have it.
Definitely.
And this was yours.
Yeah. This is one of those founding horror moments that really stuck in my mind, and it's always been there at the back. And I mean, over the years, I've looked on eBay for copies of it and thought, shall I, shan't I? And it's, oh, that's quite a lot of money. Is it in good condition? And then when this was announced, I thought, well, this is the perfect opportunity. You know, you're going to get them in as good a quality as you can. I mean,
and on paper stock that will last, unlike the sort of low quality pulp bog paper as it was originally printed on.
Yeah.
As you say, those comics, when you read them a few times, they did start to fall apart pretty quickly.
Yeah, they did deteriorate very quickly. Yeah.
Now, we have covered bits and pieces of Scream on this podcast over the years, but tell us about some of the key stories that appeared in Scream, and particularly tell us about your favourites.
Well, you had Monster by Alan Moore, the Jesus Redondo, and John Wagner and Alan Grant, about Kenny discovering his Uncle Terry living in the attic of his house, who's just promptly killed his abusive father. And it's Kenny's attempt to curtail his Uncle Terry's killing, shall we say, where he seems to either kill or maim someone every issue. And Kenny just reprimands him with, "Not again, Uncle Terry." You're kind of like, I think my reaction would be a little stronger than that. But and then, of course, you had The Dracula Files by Jerry Finley Day and Simon Furman, with some really stunning artwork by Eric Bradbury. I think his depiction of Dracula in that is incredible. It's one of those images. His is so dark, and there is no romanticism to that Dracula. He is evil through and through. There's no mixing up what his intentions are at all.
I remember when I discussed The Dracula File with a podcaster called Jim Moon, and he said, you know, this is a truly monstrous looking Dracula. He looks like a creature who does sleep in a coffin full of dirt.
Exactly. He is so dark and just the, yeah, he's evil through incarnate. There is no.
There's no two ways about it, really.
He's a monster. Yeah, exactly. The other sort of most sort of long running series that I know went beyond Scream was The 13th Floor, which for me was one of the stories actually that stood out at the time of reading it, because I think of my age, it was that little bit easier to follow.
Right.
Because of the more sort of serialized nature of it. It was a slightly different story every one or two issues. And there was a more going on, whereas the likes of something, say, like Monster and The Dracula Files, I loved the imagery of it, but I couldn't really properly follow it because, you know, my reading level wasn't there. I didn't understand that Dracula had come from behind the Iron Curtain and managed to, that was above me at that stage. Whereas I think The 13th Floor for me was that much easier to follow. And I mean, it looks beautiful.
Jose Ortiz's artwork on The 13th Floor, which is wonderful and very good on the sort of, you know, as you say, for a five-year-old, the sort of creepy crawly episodes or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Again, that had imagery in it that really stuck with me on some of those stories. And again, as I'm going through the book, that all just came flooding back. And those memories of reading it were very vivid.
And The 13th Floor went on to the Eagle Mark II, I believe. And I think Max, the computer program, even took over the editorship, allegedly, for a while.
Well, he did like having control. So he did. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
The other two sort of stories that ran along, they were less, I have less memories of them from the time. So The Terror of the Cats, Chris Lauder and Simon Furman and John Richardson, that really didn't ring an awful lot of bells with me. I don't think it really made much of an impression. And then The Night Comers by Tom Tully and again, John Richardson. Again, there's some pictures that I kind of remember, but actually on reading it now, it's definitely a story that I find I was really invested in, and I could see that I wanted to read more. So when that story came to an end, I was like, it's such a shame that this is where it ends. I would have loved to have known what this brother and sister were going to do next, where their adventures were going to lead them. And it was, yeah, just a real shame that we didn't get any more of those stories.
And they've sort of taken on the paranormal sort of ghost hunting or demon hunting roles that their dead parents had in a way. And that's, that's terrific stuff. I enjoyed that one on this particular reread of it.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff. What about some of the little odds and sods that crop up in the 15 issues? What about those? Any others stand out to you? You've mentioned, of course, we get a werewolf story.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few, actually. I mean, it doesn't really get an awful lot of mention, but I think at the time, Fiends and Neighbours.
Yes.
At the time, for me, at 5 years old, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. That every panel just seems crammed with action and you can't quite take in everything that's going on. But I think it was a great transition for me at that time of reading something like the Beano to something that's a little bit harder. So having that in amongst these more adult stories just softened that blow a little more. And I think it was actually a good move by the publishers to have something in there, because it just sort of, as I say, like kind of softened the tone within the comic itself.
It's as you say, it's more at the Beano end or monster fun end of things in terms creepy next door neighbours. We've not long ago talked about an Alan Moore story called the Beau Jeffries Saga. It's almost like the kids' version of the Beau Jeffries Saga, Live Next Door. The Addams Family or whatever, living next door to them.
It's definitely got that feel to it, hasn't it? Yeah.
And I can imagine, for the five-year-old Steve, as you say, that would be, in a way, it's a perfect story, isn't it?
Because it's really light and it's almost like a safety blanket in amongst the horror.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, okay, I've got to this part. I know I'm okay here. Oh, dear. Someone's getting killed in the next panel. I think actually I love like the Library of Death stories an awful lot, because there's such a varied tone to each one and they bring in so many different like almost subgenres, and it really allowed them to have other artists in and tried different stories. And because they're so short, and I think this is possibly the case of my short attention span, it's these shorter and sort of more little anthology stories that really stuck with me over the years. And when I'm going through the book, it was these stories that really took me back to when I was a kid.
It's nice to have a couple of anthology titles within the within an anthology horror story. But like as you say, the Library of Death and the Tales from the Grave, they're great fun, because it also introduces us again to that sort of horror host anthology horror type strand as well. So I like those cropping up in here.
It's got some of the you can see the influences actually as well on the writers. They're clearly drawing from things that they have seen. So I know that in A Ghastly Tale, there's one by the name of Green Fingers, and very much drawing from the film Creepshow, which in itself is a little anthology. It almost comic-like in its depiction of the stories. So it's the two almost go hand in hand.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. And then, of course, there is issue 8 of Scream, which, as you say, has the cover Beware the Werewolf, probably an issue that you've not been able to read for 40 years.
No.
Because your mom disappeared, this one.
Yes.
And it starts, the first page has got Dracula's a wolf. It's got a Nightcomers episode in it, and then of course it's got a Steve Dillon werewolf tale in there as well, which is just wonderful.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah,
it is. It must have been quite fun to actually see that issue, because as I say, it vanished from you.
Yeah, yeah. To actually properly read it. And I remember not having had the chance to read it and it just disappearing. I remember looking under the bed and everything. But, I mean, Steve Dillon's artwork really stands out in the middle of this issue. It's you can see his style plastered across it, and it's absolutely stunning.
Fantastic stuff. Now, we might come back to some of those stories in a moment, but this comment that I think you made on the other Facebook group for the other podcast mm-hmm. that we'll get to was about how this was, in a way, this was the gateway drug for you to a world of horror.
Yeah.
Because we often talk about comics as a gateway to reading. This was for you, I guess, an introduction to a world of horror, was it?
Definitely. I mean, like I say, I mean, I was very young, but I think the 80s and that period of time, everything pretty much terrified me. You know, the TV shows, films, things that would not normally be maybe intended to scare, still managed to have like a horror bent to them, or they'll terrify you in some way. But no, it definitely, the Scream definitely made me curious. I mean, although it scared me, I kept going back. I'd pore over the comic, and I think it then just led me to want to know more. So I would look to other forms of things that were like paranormal. Films were a little bit trickier at that age, but it definitely introduced me to horror in a way that it wasn't just ghosts and like monsters and a Dracula. I think that's where like the Library of Death really came in for me, because it kind of gave me a different view of horror, that it could be something else. And it could be science fiction. It could be almost existential. And it opened my world to something different. I mean, I was brought up in quite a religious household, so the fact my mum let me have this comic is incredible in the first place. But then we didn't have ready access to horror films as such, so I had to try and watch horror films when I could. I remember my sister renting A Nightmare on Elm Street, and I desperately wanted to watch it. And I remember watching the first 5 minutes and terrifying myself, but I loved it. And it's like that thrill, you get that spike of adrenaline, and I want more. And I think Scream does that. And like I say, having a varied range of stories within the comic not only allowed me to understand different stories, and like I say, with like the fiends and neighbors, it encouraged me to look beyond just the standard comic, the standard like child's comic, like the Beano and stuff like that. It made me want to know more.
We often, as society, find ourselves in moral panics. And in the 1970s, we'd had a comics moral panic about violence in mm-hmm. comics that led to the sort of, the sort of stripped back version of Action Comic. And then it cancelled. And that probably led to 2000 AD, where they felt they could do violence on robots and aliens and dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. In the 1980s, of course, we're going to have another moral panic mainly about videos.
Yeah.
Was Scream, as it were, as a nice, safe way to introduce the delightful, what M.R. James would call a pleasing terror to kids?
I think so, because there's nothing that was overly gory in it. And on the whole, I think the characters ended up being safe. So even Kenny with his uncle, his uncle looked after him. Mm. And I was thinking back to the Library of Death, and most of those stories, they wake up, it's like they wake from a dream, or even the 13th floor. Okay, yes, some people die, but it's usually from fright. They're not getting hacked to death. And I think the moral panic, especially with like the video nasties of the 1980s, it was very much, they were focused on gore. You know, it only took a cover to look slightly gory that it would get taken off. Even if there were films that weren't actually even horror films that got put on the video nasties list just because the cover appeared to be gory or too horrific for audiences. And I think Scream had the horror, but without the gore. And that's, for me, it allowed you to get that, still get that little thrill, but without, and it, by kind of like sidestepping that moral panic, as it were.
And we keep mentioning this, or I keep mentioning this other podcast, The Evolution of Horror, which I may as well get it out. But they, Mike Muntzer there, covers the history of the horror genre by looking at one particular subgenre in each season.
Yep.
And I'm just struck that Scream, in a way, gives you a perfect introduction to many of the sort of subgenres that he's covered, even when he's doing his current season about Nature Bites Back. And you could say that, you know, Terror of the Cats.
Definitely.
You know,
definitely. Yeah.
There's usually some form of beastie. And in this one particularly, it's the cats. Although, of course, memorably, there's also the spiders in the 13th floor as well.
Yeah.
Did it introduce you, and did it sort of lead you to go on to sort of an interest in particular genres of horror?
It's funny you should ask, actually. I think I've come to the conclusion, actually, that I think anthology horror is probably my favourite horror. It gives you the short stories. As I say, my attention span is not the best, but they get to the point. You get that little thrill, that little burst of what you want to watch. And then you're quickly moving on to the next story. And it's the sort, anthologies tend to be the film that I'll put on when it kind of like, I don't want to fully engage. I want something on, almost like a comfort film. It always feels weird calling horror films a comfort film, but it is. It's, you can just engage as and when you want. You can think, oh, I'm not as fussed about this story. I will do something else because I know something, the next story is really good. I love this one. I think for me, although I love loads of different horror films, and my favorite is The Thing, which you'd think is a sci-fi.
Can't go wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Perfect film for me. But I will tend to go towards films like Dr. Terror's House of Horror, Asylum. A lot of those, Hammer and Amicus, especially the Amicus anthologies. But also like some of the newer ones like VHS are really good. And that is what I do tend to go to. Even like in TV series, like Twilight Zone is a massive... Right.
Yeah.
I love The Twilight Zone, and that's got quite a lot of horror elements to it. And then Rod Serling's follow-up to that, The Night Gallery, is very much a horror-based anthology TV series. And I've watched that several times, really enjoyed it. So, yeah, I think Scream has definitely been my grounding for horror.
You've mentioned a few anthology horror films and TV series there that we hope will turn up when Mike Muntzer does a anthology horror season. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to throw in one more. I'm hoping that he will start somewhere around Dead of Night.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. That's a cracker.
That is a cracker, yes. If anybody's not seen that black and white 1945, I think, horror film.
Yeah,
just a wondrous thing. That's the one with, of course, Michael Redgrave and the ventriloquist dummy, which is the one that people mostly remember.
Yeah, I mean, just the imagery from that is enough. Is a stuff of nightmares. It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, I'm very getting good. Off topic here, but I know Matthew Sweet, the sort of cultural commentator, says Michael Redgrave's performance is not only one of the greatest performances in horror, it's possibly one of the greatest performances in film.
Yeah, it is very good. Yeah.
Right, I must turn you back to 40 Years of Scream. Let's just say that this is a beautiful hardback.
It is.
It gives you pretty much the whole 15 issues. As I say, at the back we've got some extras, some games, some unpublished artwork, some bits and pieces, some adverts that appeared in other comics. Of course, as you say, they probably couldn't get around the problems of having the adverts for 1984 products in this reprint, although it would have been delightful to see some ads for Monster Munch and the like.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I would have loved that. I really would.
Two great introductions by Ian Rimmer, who was Ghastly McNasty, and Barry Tomlinson. And I will read and listen to anything Barry Tomlinson says about the history of British comics. So that's wonderful as well. This, I think, might be the first time that the Treasury of British Comics have done one of these sort of complete comics collections in a hardback like this. Would you like to see other examples of this, bound copies of like a complete run of comics or a complete short section of comics, as it were?
Yeah, definitely. I have collected an awful lot of 2000 AD graphic novels, but a lot of the Hachette partwork collections, and it's unfortunately some of them have sat there gathering dust. Whereas I think if you've got them in this way, they're a little bit easier to digest because you're not just trying to trawl through one story. It's broken up and you kind of go, okay, it's 4 or 5 pages. Oh, now we're going on to something different. And it's continually engaging you with something new. And as I say, with all anthologies, if there's something you're not that fussed about, get through it because there's something else that you're going to like coming up very soon. And that's what I think one of the reasons why I like 2000 AD is because of that anthology sort of way of telling stories. You work through, okay, maybe you don't like this current Judge Dredd story, but you're going to have Strontium Dog coming up. So you know that there's something you're going to like in it. So I would love to see some of the older comics done in this way, even 2000 AD done, like the first sort of 10 issues or 20 issues done as a hardbound edition, and to have those that feel like you are reading the comic in as best a way as you possibly can, as it was intended.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said to you before, I know you're not the only fan who's been saying, please put out the first 10 or 20 issues of 2000 AD in a bound copy, just like, you know, just to cut the issues. Some people have been calling that for ages. I mentioned there was also a David Roach special edition, a slipcase edition with a David Roach cover. This one has got the sort of Cam Kennedy cover of the image of the ghoul on the front cover. It is available digitally at the moment, $9.99. It appears that this has sold out for the Treasury. So if you've got the hardback, hang on to it.
Literally treasure it.
Yes. Now, we play this game on the podcast, Steve, where we imagine that the original artwork had survived and that we could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
You've picked out from the 15 issues and all the sort of surrounding material a couple of Grail pages. What would they be that you would love to own if you could?
Well, I mean, I was going through it and there's quite a list, actually. Can I just say there is quite a few.
Okay, that, buckle up.
So I have narrowed it down to the two that I would... These are definitely the two that I would love to have. But these were pages that I saw that, one, took me back to my childhood, and two, I looked at them and just like, the artwork blew me away. So in terms of pages, page 116 of The Terror of the Cats with the main sort of the top panel.
Oh yes,
being
yeah, got it now.
Dominated by the cat's eyes, is just stunning, absolutely stunning. And then the shock image of the two looks like a leopard and a tiger, also being controlled. And it's like, oh hello, it's not just house cats, it's all of them. But that artwork is absolutely beautiful. The one image, I mean, Eric Bradbury's, as I said earlier, Dracula artwork is incredible, but I think page 40 really encapsulates all of it for me, as he's sort of, I want to say ensconced, but almost blended into the background, as though he's part of the trees, part of the foliage, and he's just emerging from the shadows, about to attack this hunter. And the eyes are blank, and you just think this is a monster at the peak of his power. He doesn't stand a chance. This man, this is a Dracula that is going to rip your throat out. He's not going to try and tempt you.
He's not going to sparkle in the sun.
He definitely is not. No, no. He is. There is no mercy from this Dracula. And also, Monster on page 160. I'm way too many that I'm listing off. Yeah, page 160 of Monster with the two risen bodies that Kenny has previously buried. That again, just stunning, absolutely stunning. But this is going to come a little bit left field, but for me, it's actually one of the Library of Death pages. It was 146, A Break in the Country. Now, as I was first reading this edition, and I flicked ahead through some of the pages, and this picture just took, I've already said it several times, it took me back, but I remember having nightmares about these images of these half ant, half fly creatures, and this boy being turned into an alien creature himself. And what I love about it is that, as I said earlier, it's not, most of these are like, I woke up from a dream, it wasn't real. No, this is actually happening. He is changing into this creature. And I had to, when I came across these pictures, I had to stop, because it just immediately took me back. And I love the crispness of the artwork. It is, and it, to me, even now, I look at it and I'm like terrified by the prospect of it. But you were saying about also like the covers. And so I was looking through the covers, and it was either the long lost issue 8 werewolf one.
Yes.
But I think actually in terms of covers, issue 10, the Dracula of issue 10 is so iconic. The blood running down either side of his mouth, it's so stark and beautiful that it would have to be that cover. Having that hanging on the wall would be amazing.
So that is Eric Bradbury again on the cover to issue 10. Mm-hmm. Not Scream, not for the nervous, as it said, Britain's creepiest comic, something to get your teeth into. That's wonderful. So you've got, I think I'm safe to say that you haven't picked any Grail pages that anybody else has previously chosen. So I think we've stuck by the rules as well.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm pleased
about that. They become virtually yours. And I will post all these images on the social media the week this episode comes out. You've got some Eric Bradbury. You've got some Jesus Redondo from Monster. You've got some John Richardson from The Cats. Somebody called T. Coleman is the...
I'm not sure who that was, but...
No, I'm not sure. I will perhaps find out more before I post this up.
He probably doesn't realise what he's responsible for.
Yes. And I see from the credits that that is written by Malcolm Shaw, who wrote The Sentinels for Misty as well. So, yeah, you've got some very good, great selection there of pages.
Probably too many, but I couldn't narrow it. It was very hard to narrow it down.
Yeah, it's a tough choice, isn't it? Particularly when you've got 15 issues to pick from of the complete comic. Beautifully bound on great paper in a wonderful hardback from the Treasury of British Comics. Well done to them, I think, is the answer. You know,
yeah, definitely.
Fantastic stuff. Steve, that's wonderful. I mean, I'm sure, you know, we're just going to highly recommend the 40 Years of Scream. You know, if you can get hold of a hardback particularly, but if not, get the digital because you will have it and you're able to read through the whole comic. And it's just such good fun reading.
Oh, definitely. It's 100%.
Tremendous. Yeah.
The as we've said earlier, the anthology nature of the comic, just it keeps you engaged at all times. And like I say, that I think the even just the little short stories are fantastic. I mean, Cam Kennedy on at Death's Door, that first one, the artwork is incredible, and I can completely understand why they've then put it on the front cover of the book. It's just so stunning.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone would be disappointed in having this edition on their shelves.
I sometimes get to pick a Grail page myself, and I think I might go for a bit of Steve Dillon Werewolf, as you haven't picked it. So I'll post the page of that as well.
I don't blame you. It's very, very nice.
Yeah. There's no doubt that I would never, ever be able to afford a Steve Dillon Curse of the Werewolf Judge Dredd page. So possibly, I might sneak one from Beware the Werewolf and Scream.
Yeah, it's quite close. You can kind of go, okay.
Who do you want to draw a werewolf story? I want Steve Dillon.
Yeah. I mean, fairness, the woman that's sort of diving away from him at the beginning does have a little bit of a Judge Anderson look to her.
Yeah, true, yes. Fantastic stuff, Steve. Thank you so much for coming on the book club to talk about it. I sort of hijacked you from the Evolution of Horror Facebook group. We'll just mention the podcast again.
Yeah.
Mike Munzer's wonderful podcast, very successful, has its own, as you say, has its Facebook discussion group. He just talks about so many wonderful films with so many wonderful guests, doesn't he?
Oh, he's so engaging. He has some really great guests on there and infinitely listenable to, if that's a word. Yeah. You know, you can... When I was really getting into horror films, it was a great introduction to the world of horror films, because I don't think you can kind of grasp all the subgenres and you think, oh, I've never heard of these films. And it just... In fairness, he's got a lot to answer for, because my Blu-ray collection has expanded exponentially and... Yeah, I wouldn't miss it for the world. It's such a great community as well on that Facebook group.
Because horror fans, as he frequently says on the podcast, horror fans are some of the most enthusiastic and empathic people. They're just, you know, lovely people. You wouldn't think it, but, you know, we are mostly.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I mean, I've met my fiance through the evolution of horror.
Oh, blimey.
So, yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. It's been quite influential in my life. So, yeah.
So that's the Evolution of Horror podcast. And as you say, I come away from every season hearing him talk about some wonderful films that I know, but also coming away with a list of films and go, I've never heard of that. Sounds great.
Yeah, definitely.
And before we were recording, we were talking a little bit about your own projects. Your day job has you mostly doing echocardiograms at the moment and keeping very busy.
Yes.
You know, working in cardiac physiology, but also you was telling me you're sort of working on a little bit of screenwriting. Is that horror inflected by any chance?
I'm not quite sure how you guessed that correctly. I mean, it's slow progress, but it's getting there. I have a few scripts on the boil in there, sort of several drafts in, but they all tend to go down the horror vein, as it were. Again, all different subgenres. I think maybe I'll write my own anthology because I seem to dip into all sorts of different things. So maybe, that'll be my next project, actually doing an anthology film of my own work.
Sounds great. I'm in.
Good.
And you can find Steve, if you want to talk to him about the history of Scream and its role as a gateway drug to horror, you can find him on the Facebook page, discussion group for the Evolution of Horror. Wonderful stuff, Steve. Thank you so much for giving up your time. I know you've got an important meeting tomorrow night relevant to something we were talking about. We've squeezed this in. There's also a big semi-final going on at the moment, but we'll find out more about that in a little while. Thank you so much, Steve.
No, thank you for having me, Eamon. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, find all of these links, including links to the Evolution of Horror, at megacitybookclub.com. Follow us on social media, all of them apart from that horrible Twitter, which we're no longer on. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, particularly if you've got a book or a comic that you'd like to come on and talk about. So that's it. Until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
Goodbye from me. Bye.